From the WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the unlikely history of the Pledge of Allegiance. Richard Ellis says it's darker, more unsettling, and complex than the version peddled by politicians. We'll talk with Ellis about his new book, To the Flag. He writes, the words of the pledge have inspired millions, but they've also been used to coerce and intimidate, to compel conformity, and to silence dissent. And why does the Confederate flag still wave in many places more than a century after the end of the Civil War, even though many see it as a symbol of white supremacy? We'll talk with John Kosky about his new book on the history of the rebel flag. He directs the library of the Museum of the Confederacy in Virginia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the first things many of us learn to recite as a child is the Pledge of Allegiance. In a new book about the history of the pledge, my guest Richard Ellis says the daily recitation in schools and legislatures across the nation tells as much about our anxieties as a nation as it does about our highest ideals, anxieties about immigrants, radicals, communism, and materialism. The pledge was written in 1892 as a salute for schoolchildren to say during a week-long public school celebration of the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's discovery of America. The magazine Youth's Companion promoted the celebration and declared its ambition to see the U.S. flag raised over every public school as part of the commemoration. The pledge was written by one of the magazine's writers, Francis Bellamy. Richard Ellis's new book is called To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance. He's a professor of politics at Willamette University in Oregon. I asked him why he wanted to write about the Pledge of Allegiance.
One of the things that initially interested me in the book was why it was when the Ninth Circuit Court decided that Under God was unconstitutional in June 2002, why did people get so upset about it? And indeed, why does it matter to us so much that our children pledge allegiance at all? It struck me as an interesting ritual, and it still strikes me as a curious ritual. It's unusual by the standards of Western democracies. Most Western liberal democracies don't have their children start the day by pledging allegiance to the nation. And certainly not pledging allegiance to a nation under God. And so I think what drew me to the history of the Pledge of Allegiance was answering that question, why did the United States do this and why did we care so much about it? Because clearly the reaction to that decision was intense.
Let's look at the history of the Pledge of Allegiance. What do you think is the most common assumption about the pledge that is actually false?
I think the most common assumption about the Pledge of Allegiance is that we've always had it. It was somehow put there by the founding fathers. And the Pledge of Allegiance isn't written until 1892, 100 years after the founding of the country. So why in 1892? And in 1892, what one has is increasing immigration. And in particular, immigration that's bringing people who look different, no longer Western and Northern Europeans, no longer just Protestants, but Catholics and Jews and from Southern and Eastern Europe. And there's a great anxiety about that in the country in the late 1880s and into the 1890s. The misconception is that it's simply a statement about our ideals. It is that too, with liberty and justice for all, but it's also a statement that reflects a nation's anxieties.
So you're saying it reflects the anxiety of immigrants coming here. We want to make sure that they're pledging allegiance to the flag.
Right, right. And the adults, you can't do anything about the adults because they can't be reached, but what these people feels that the children can be reached. They can be molded. Interestingly, when the pledge is slightly revised, because the original pledge was, I pledge allegiance to my flag, and it was revised in the early 1920s by a collection of patriotic and veterans groups who felt they were worried that when these children were saying my flag, they meant the home country's flag. And so it was changed to the flag of the United States of America so that these immigrant children couldn't mistake which flag they were pledging or couldn't surreptitiously be pledging to their home country's flag.
Would you recite the pledge as it was initially written?
It was originally written, I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. A much more elegant version of the pledge than we currently have.
The word indivisible is in the original pledge. Mm-hmm. And how much does that have to do with the recently divided nation during the Civil War?
Everything. It's absolutely a response to concerns about the Civil War. The more general anxiety is that in the post-war period, people have forgotten the sacrifices of the greatest generation, to use our phraseology for the World War II. But there was this sense that the Civil War generation was the greatest generation. They had made the supreme sacrifices for the nation and for the values for which it stood. And that in the late 19th century, people are absorbed with making money, the pursuit of individual happiness, materialism, and that they are forgetting about the sacrifices that the previous generations had made.
The pledge was written by Francis Bellamy and James B. Upham.
Yeah, the pledge is written by Bellamy. Upham is the one whose idea it is to have a flag over every schoolhouse.
Now, you mentioned that one of the reasons for the pledge was the fear of new immigrants, the fear of immigrants who didn't look like the people who already lived here. Where did Bellamy stand on immigration?
Bellamy very much shared that fear of immigration. And one of the things that drew me into this story was Francis Bellamy's biography and his beliefs, because what I had heard, the little bit I heard, I did hear that, well, Francis Bellamy was a Christian socialist, and I thought, well, that's interesting. But when I look more deeply, it seemed that the Christian socialism had a lot less to do with the pledge than Bellamy's fears about immigrants, fears about Catholics. And I came across something that Bellamy wrote a couple years after the pledge. It just struck me as quite ironic that the author of Will with Liberty and Justice for All also wrote this. He said, "The hard, inescapable fact is that men are not born equal. Neither are they born free, but all in bonds to their ancestors and their environments. The success of government by the people will depend upon the stuff that people are made of. The people must guard, more jealously even than their liberties, the quality of their blood. A democracy like ours cannot afford to throw itself open to the world. Where every man is a lawmaker, every dull-witted or fanatical immigrant admitted to our citizenship is a bane to the commonwealth. Where all classes of society merge insensibly into one another, every alien immigrant or inferior race may bring corruption to the stock. There are races, more or less akin to our own, whom we may admit freely and get nothing but advantage from the infusion of their wholesome blood, but there are other races which we cannot assimilate without a lowering of our racial standard, which should be as sacred to us as the sanctity of our homes."
Which races or ethnic groups was he most worried about admitting?
Southern Europeans, Eastern Europeans, Jews, Catholics. Those are the primary religious groups and source of origin that he's concerned about.
Now, you're right that Bellamy, the author of the Pledge of Allegiance, was not only concerned about immigrants, outsiders who might come in and change our society in a bad way. He was worried about internal foes. Who was he worried about inside America?
When Bellamy's writing the pledge, his primary concern is immigrants and the native-born who aren't patriotic enough, not concerned about the Civil War generation. But later on, in the 1920s, as the pledge starts to spread, because originally the pledge is written for a single occasion, Bellamy doesn't think this is going to be something that's said every day in school or every week in school. But as it begins to spread in the early part of the 20th century and begins to become a widespread practice in public schools, that's when Bellamy starts to talk about the pledge in some different ways, and in particular about combating radical subversion, which becomes a strong concern for Bellamy and for others in the wake of World War I and the Russian Revolution. And so he writes about the way in which the pledge can be used to combat internal subversion. The pledge, in Bellamy's view, is almost like a vaccination. It will inoculate these children. They will start to feel an allegiance to the nation before they even understand the words, so that when they are exposed to the radical virus, they will be inoculated. And that's very much the way Bellamy saw the pledge.
My guest is Richard Ellis, author of the new book, To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Richard Ellis. His new book is called To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance. Let's talk a little bit about how children were supposed to say the pledge. And initially, you weren't putting your right hand over your heart when you said the pledge. What were you doing?
Right. The pledge, as it's originally designed, and James Upham is the man who comes up with the salute, it begins with a military salute. I pledge allegiance to my flag. And at the words, my flag, the arm would be extended up into the air, palm upwards. And so visually, that looked quite a lot like the Heil Hitler salute. And so in the 30s, people start to become concerned about that, the late 30s and early 40s, that this Pledge of Allegiance, this salute, looks an awful lot like the Nazi salute. And in fact, there are pictures of people saying the Pledge of Allegiance from this period. And even though Upham's original idea was to have the arm and palm up, extended upwards, in fact, many people did it with the palm down. And so it really did look an awful lot like the Nazi salute for a while.
When did the Pledge of Allegiance become mandatory in schools?
The first flag salute statute dates from 1898 in New York State. But the first state to make the Pledge of Allegiance specifically mandatory was Washington State, and that happens in 1919, and that is in direct response and out of a fear of a general strike that happens in Seattle at exactly that time. So the Pledge of Allegiance, in terms of a mandatory state statute, dates from that period, and it differs across states. But essentially, the Pledge of Allegiance in the period between the 1910s and the 1943 Supreme Court ruling is mandatory. If you don't say the Pledge of Allegiance, the school can throw you out of school. And in fact, they did throw the students out of school and sometimes arrested their parents because the students weren't, they accused the parents of creating truants since the kids couldn't go to school. Even though it was the schools telling the kids they couldn't go to school, the parents were arrested.
So the Supreme Court declared the mandatory pledge laws unconstitutional?
Right. What happened is in the 1930s, 1935 in particular, Jehovah's Witnesses start to refuse to pledge allegiance to the flag. They decide that it's idolatrous to do so, and they refuse to pledge allegiance to the flag, and they get thrown out of school. But unlike some of the previous religious sects that had refused to say the Pledge of Allegiance, the Jehovah's Witnesses aren't shy about using the court system. So the Jehovah's Witnesses take the case to the courts, and they have lots of cases, and they lose in almost all of these cases. And in fact, they lose in front of the United States Supreme Court in 1940. And the United States Supreme Court says in an 8-1 ruling, and the decision, the opinion is written by Felix Frankfurter, an FDR appointee and a founding member of the ACLU. And the Supreme Court says the school board has the power and the state has the power to expel students from school if they don't say the Pledge of Allegiance, that the courts need to take a hands-off approach, and the state has a reasonable interest in promoting, a compelling interest, in fact, in promoting patriotism. Well, the reaction to that opinion is strongly critical. And in particular, what happens is you get a lot of violence visited against Jehovah's Witnesses. They get beaten up. in one case, is a case of castration, being forced to drink castor oil. And the people that are doing this are pointing to the Supreme Court case and saying, look, the Supreme Court says they're traitors. The court people, some of the people on the court get very nervous about these events, and they start to feel like we made a mistake. And so 3 years later, 1943, on Flag Day, Justice Jackson, Robert Jackson, who was the Attorney General for FDR in 1940, but now sits on the Supreme Court, he writes the opinion, and the Supreme Court changes course. And in some of the most famous language, Justice Jackson says it's a matter of freedom of expression, and if a student's choose not to say the Pledge of Allegiance, that should be something they should be able to choose to do, to not to say the Pledge of Allegiance.
So the Supreme Court reversed its own decision?
Yeah, yeah. And it's very unusual in 3 years. And you have to understand the first opinion in 1940 was handed down at the time that the Nazis are just beginning to roll over Europe. It's the spring and early summer of 1940. The Nazis are rolling over Europe, and there is tremendous anxiety. And so there's a feeling on the part of the court that the state really does have a compelling interest to promote patriotism.
The two most controversial words in the pledge are under God, words that are still being contested today in the courts. And these two words were added in 1954 during the Cold War. How much was under God a way of trying to differentiate America from, you know, quote, godless communists, unquote?
Yeah, it had it had everything to do with that. It's putting the pledge at the service of the fight against communism, because at the end of the Cold War, the communists posed primarily just a military threat. But in the early years of the Cold War, communism was seen as a dangerous rival for the allegiance of the people of the United States and the people across the world. The United States stood for liberty and justice, but the communists claimed to stand for justice and equality too. And people worried that communism was able to instill a fierce, fanatical loyalty that the West couldn't match. And so many people came to believe in those early years of the Cold War that fighting communism required recommitting the nation to its religious roots, that it was religion, the belief in God, that really differentiated us from the godless, atheistic communists. And that's where our sense of commitment would come from. And of course, if God's on our side in this cosmic battle with communism, that's an immensely reassuring thought at a terribly anxious time. One of the things that's useful to remember is that the change to the pledge is one of only a number of things that were done in the early 1950s to inject religion into the public sphere, and they all have to do with this concern about communism. In 1952, Congress mandates an annual National Day of Prayer. Eisenhower begins each cabinet meeting with the silent prayer. Today's National Prayer Breakfast, which was then called the Presidential Prayer Breakfast, dates from that period. Congress created a prayer room in the Capitol during that period. In 1955, Congress added In God We Trust to paper money. Coins already had it. In 1956, In God We Trust became the national motto, replacing E Pluribus Unum. The post office even got into the act and issued a stamp adorned with In God We Trust on it, and it was unveiled on national TV by the president, members of his cabinet, and religious leaders.
Michael Newdow challenged the words under God in the pledge, and in 2002, a federal court sided with him, but 2 years later, the Supreme Court threw out the decision and basically said that Michael Newdow didn't have any standing in the case because he brought this case on behalf of his daughter, but the Supreme Court said that since he and his wife were divorced and he didn't have direct custody over the daughter, that he had no standing in the case.
Right.
So he's challenging it again with right. four other people. What's this current case?
Well, this case will force the Supreme Court to take the subject on its merits. It was able to decide the case on a technical issue of standing, and therefore avoid the question of whether including under God in the Pledge of Allegiance violates the Establishment Clause. But in any event, there seem to be three possibilities. One is you follow Rehnquist and say that Establishment Clause precedents really aren't relevant here because the Pledge of Allegiance is not a religious exercise. Under God is a descriptive statement about our belief in God in the past, our founders' belief in God. And so it's not about our aspirations to be a nation under God. It's a descriptive statement. It's not a religious exercise. You can also envision a version of that that talks about it being fundamentally ceremonial deism. It's like in God we trust on the money. It's drained of its religious content. And that's one possibility. The second possibility is that the court would decide to follow Clarence Thomas and argue that the pledge case shows why Supreme Court jurisprudence in this area has to be rethought and rolled back. And if the lower courts applied Establishment Clause jurisprudence and found the Under God Clause to be unconstitutional, that only shows how bad those previous Establishment Court cases and precedents are, and we need to rethink fundamentally Establishment Clause jurisprudence. And the third possibility is that it follows the Ninth Circuit ruling, which was to apply Establishment Clause precedents and strike down the Pledge of Allegiance. And I'm not a lawyer, but I would think that one is more likely than two or three.
Richard Ellis is the author of To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Working Mother Magazine, featuring in the June issue its list of the best companies for multicultural women with profiles of each company, online at workingmother.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our conversation with Richard Ellis about the history of the Pledge of Allegiance, then the story of the Confederate battle flag, a flag that still flies in many places, even though many Americans regard it as a symbol of white supremacy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Richard Ellis, author of the new book, To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance. One of the things you trace in your history of the Pledge of Allegiance is how the pledge became politicized. And of course, you know, you write about how during the war in Vietnam that a lot of people refused to stand for the pledge as a way to protest the war. And then you write about the 1988 presidential campaign between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis, and you say that the pledge became a partisan issue in that campaign. How was the pledge used?
Well, using the pledge, first of all, the Pledge of Allegiance becomes available to be used in partisan battles because the protests against the pledge start to be associated with a political point of view in the 60s and 70s, whereas prior to that, it was often religious objections, and it didn't have the same kind of political partisan implications that it started to take on in the 60s and 70s. And so in the 88 campaign, the Republicans, for the first time, really make it a national issue. It had been used in some local campaigns in political ways in New York State and other places. But they're able to put Dukakis in a very uncomfortable position. Dukakis had previously vetoed a state law requiring the Pledge of Allegiance. And it was pretty clear that on legal grounds, Dukakis was on very solid footing. But the problem was that the American public believed and still believe to this day that the Pledge of Allegiance should be mandatory. And public opinion polls clearly show that. So Dukakis talks about the legalisms, but for the public, this is just another piece of evidence that courts are out of step with the public. And so Bush is able to use that. He's in a win-win situation there. He's able to use that and play on people's feelings that there's these liberal courts and that they're out of touch with the people and that they're even telling us that we can't require students to say the Pledge of Allegiance, which indeed the courts had been saying since 1943, but oftentimes school boards, it took a while for them to get the message.
One of the kind of funny things about the pledge is that it's mostly, you know, like school children have recited it, and you learn it when you're like five or six, and you don't know what any of it means, particularly the word indivisible. I mean, most kids don't even know how to pronounce it. And, you know, if you listen to kids saying the pledge, it's just a lot of, like, odd syllables strung together. So right. It's really, the language is much too formal for children to truly comprehend, although, you get the gist of it, but...
Right, right. Well, indivisible, of course, is the classic one. Lots of kids think it's invisible, but Bellamy did understand that. He understood that kids, when they were saying this, wouldn't necessarily understand what they were saying. But later on, when it was became clear that the pledge was something that would be said on a regular basis, he thought of the pledge as something that touched kids' feelings. And what it was not about thinking. It was about attaching the heart to the nation in a way. And so it's a pre-rational attachment. And later on, when they were called upon to explain, you know, what their country was about, they would then go back to those words. They would become part of their memory. Bellamy's way of thinking about it, he said it would do their thinking for them. It would be the way they understood who they were when they became older. It just got lodged in their subconscious. And Bellamy thought that was a good thing. I mean, that's the way propaganda works, too. And that's why some people are a little more nervous about it.
You're a historian, and I'm not sure if you'll be comfortable answering this in a personal way. But after learning the history of the pledge, are you any more or less inclined to want to stand and recite it?
One of the things that makes the Pledge of Allegiance, thinking about the Pledge of Allegiance, difficult is I think there are some people who feel uncomfortable pledging allegiance to the nation. It's not that they don't feel patriotic, but that they feel that there's something paradoxical or odd or strange about the most individualistic nation of the world, the leader of the free world, requiring its children to declare daily their allegiance to the state. And there's something illiberal about that. On the other hand, there are people for whom it feels the most natural thing in the world and a very authentic way of declaring their love for their country. And for those people, they have a hard time understanding the other people, and the other people have a hard time understanding the perspective of the other people, I think.
Richard Ellis, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Richard Ellis is the author of To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance. He's a professor of politics at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon. Coming up, the story behind the Confederate battle flag and why Americans still fight over its meaning. This is Fresh Air. Americans are still fighting about whether it's acceptable to display the Confederate battle flag and still disagreeing about its meaning. Does the flag represent white supremacy, or is it merely a sentimental image of Southern heritage? My guest, John Koski, is the author of the new book, The Confederate Battle Flag, America's Most Embattled Emblem. He's the historian and library director at the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. He says he's not emotionally involved in the argument over the flag. He's a historian who studies the Confederacy and its lasting impact on the nation. Would you describe the Confederate battle flag and what it was first used for?
First, a purist would tell you, the purist that is an historian who's interested in vexillology, history of flags, would tell you that there was no such thing as the Confederate battle flag. So nodding in that direction and acknowledging that, I will answer the question that what I say when I refer to it is the blue cross, the blue sideways or St. Andrew's cross or saltire studded with white stars on a field of red. In some iterations, it was perfectly square. The more common versions of it are rectangular. And it was first suggested as the national flag of the Confederacy in 1861, not adopted as the national flag of the Confederacy, but adopted about a few months later as the battle flag of one of the armies of the Confederacy, what became known as the Army of Northern Virginia, Lee's Army. In a perfectly square pattern, adopted because it was so different from any other flag.
So if this flag was just like one of the battle flags that was used and it wasn't the official flag of the Confederacy, why has this flag become the most potent symbol of the Confederacy?
It certainly has become the most potent symbol. And some people, I think, are operating under the assumption that it became so in our own time, that in a sense it's we stupid Americans of the 20th and 21st century who have conflated all Confederate flags and made this pattern of whatever size and shape to be the Confederate flag and the Confederate battle flag. But I argue that really during the course of the war itself, it became the most potent symbol. And even by the end of the war, by 1865, it was not only the battle flag of one of the armies, it had been diffused through the agency of various generals who had been involved in its adoption as the battle flag of several of the major field armies. It was known, at least, in most of the theaters of war, most widely associated with Lee's army, which was by far the most successful of the Confederate armies. And more importantly, in 1863, it was incorporated into a new design of the Confederate national flag. The Confederate national flag of 1861, which was the one known as the Stars and Bars, was replaced in 1863 with another one sometimes called the Stainless Banner, which was simply a white flag with what we know as the battle flag up in its upper left corner. So it became part of the official Confederate flag by the end of the war, and not because of any accident or any cobble, but because it was, as you say, the most potent symbol of Confederate nationalism.
Who designed the flag, and what was it supposed to represent?
Usually the designer is somewhat under dispute as such. Most of us give credit to a man named William Porche Miles. He was a congressman from South Carolina who had originally designed, he had been inspired by a secession flag he had seen in South Carolina in the winter of 1860-61, a blue Christian or St. George's cross on a red field. But he, at the request of the Jewish community of Charleston, which was very patriotically Confederate and influential, asked him not to start this new nation with what they considered to be a sectarian Christian symbol. So he used a saltire instead, what he said was a heraldic symbol rather than a Christian symbol. He did not regard that cross as a St. Andrew's cross, but as a saltire, heraldic device, blue on a field of red. But others claimed credit for it later, and particularly the two generals who helped to adopt it as the battle flag and diffuse it to other parts of the Confederacy, Generals Beauregard and Joseph Johnston, are sometimes given credit. But ultimately, it was Miles who believed in it and pushed it and led to its adoption.
When the Civil War was over, how come this Confederate battle flag didn't end with the war? How come it had a life that went on?
That's the critical question in all of this. If it were something that was simply associated with the life of the Confederacy and had been furled, as the poet Father Abram Ryan said when he advised Southerners to furl that banner to "It is holy," the assumption being that it was a beloved symbol of the lost cause and of the Confederacy, to be revered but never to be seen again. It would likely to be today a controversial symbol, but not nearly as much as it has been, because it didn't disappear, except for a few years in the immediate aftermath of the war. But within 5 years or so of the end of the war, as the southern states were being readmitted into the Union, it was used as a memorial symbol at funerals, primarily in a sort of mournful, funereal, commemorative way. But by the end of the 19th century, used in a more aggressive way, that is, by associated with the school of thought that the Confederacy may have lost, but it was right, and a celebration of the Confederate cause and of Confederate heroes. Thus, the flag, this flag in particular, was used in memorial monument dedications, in meetings of Confederate heritage organizations that were formed by 1900, and at veterans' parades and celebrations of the lost cause. So it was a visible symbol on the southern landscape, but in almost an exclusively commemorative way by 1900.
How did the flag start to become associated with 20th century white supremacy and racism?
Primarily, the real turning point as such was in 1948, when the so-called Dixiecrat Party, the state's rights Democratic Party, broke away from Harry Truman's Democratic Party in protest of Truman's embrace of civil rights and support for the Civil Rights Commission and the civil rights agenda of the Democratic Party. And the state's rights party, the Dixiecrats, nominated the late Strom Thurmond as the president. And at the convention of the Dixiecrats in Birmingham in 1948, many of the delegates appeared on the convention floor in these uproarious rallies with battle flags and pictures of Robert E. Lee. But in the course of the campaign, even though the party leaders did not want to have the battle flag as a symbol and did not want to be seen as a purely Southern party, the followers of the party did. And even before that, in the early to mid-1940s, best that I can determine, the Ku Klux Klan began using the battle flag in its rituals in a limited way. And then all the more, and after the Dixiecrats and after the Brown decision of 1954, and the South mobilized to fight against federal interference with Jim Crow and segregation, the battle flag became a ubiquitous symbol in the hands of not the Klan necessarily, them too, but really more importantly, the ordinary white Southerners. It became a symbol of opposition to integration.
And then the Confederate battle flag started to be flown on campuses in the South. How did the flag become part of campus life, and what was the significance of that?
The best I can determine on this is that in 1920s, 30s primarily, it had become a familiar part of campus life primarily through the aegis of the Old South fraternity called Kappa Alpha, which still exists today and has had many issues over the last decades in trying to dissuade its members from embracing the battle flag. But Kappa Alpha had been founded at Washington College, now Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, of which one old retired general named Robert E. Lee was president. And it was a fraternity founded in order to preserve and honor and ennoble the causes, the chivalric ideals of the Old South. In a sense, Kappa Alpha was a memorial organization like other Confederate memorial organizations. But as time passed and it became less of a memorial organization perhaps and more of a fraternity, after all, we're talking about 18, 22-year-old boys, the reverence for the flag became perhaps a bit lessened, and it became more of a feature of campus life. And through Kappa Alpha, other fraternities embraced it. And this became particularly important in the World War II era as more Southern schools started playing intercollegiate sports against Northern schools. What better symbol of the South, particularly when you're taking on the Northern school, than the battle flag? The battle flag had become, by the turn of the century, and particularly by the middle of the 20th century, a shorthand symbol, a logo, if you will, for South. So that campus presence made its way into the political realm. It made its way as well into the American military during World War II.
The Confederate flag has also been used in stock car races. How did it get associated with stock car races? And do you see it much today in NASCAR?
It began, in fact, in that magic year of 1948, and about that time, with the birth of the raceway at Darlington, South Carolina, the Super Speedway, and really the birth of NASCAR as we know it today in that same time frame. It was embraced very much at Darlington and became, if not an officially endorsed symbol, a widely used symbol in the winner's circle. The symbolism all over the track at Darlington from the late 1940s into the 1970s and early 1980s. Even though NASCAR never has been an exclusively Southern sport, it had a Southern flavor, and the flag seemed a natural symbol for the sport. Today, it's been de-emphasized officially since about the 1980s or so. And today, as NASCAR reaches out to African-American audiences, the battle flag's presence in the infield and among race fans has become something of an issue. And a lot of people are burning up the wires of the internet and discussing NASCAR's apparent effort to distance the sport from the battle flag and resenting it highly.
I'd like you to choose one of the current controversies surrounding the flying of the Confederate flag or the use of the Confederate flag and tell us what you think is going on there.
One of the most interesting ones, and rich, although it may lead me to a very long answer, is the Elmwood Cemetery in Charlotte, North Carolina. Within this public cemetery, and public is a critical part of the equation here, is a small section walled off where there are Confederate graves, and there had been a large flagpole with a Confederate battle flag on it. And at the behest of a group, I believe, of African-American citizens who said that the flag was visible from outside the gates of the cemetery, the city took it down. And after holding a couple of hearings at which typically the majority of the people present were defenders of the flag, vocal but polite, the city manager decided anyway to take the flag down, take down the flagpole, and in fact cap off the flagpole so that another one could not be erected in its place. It cuts to the core of several issues at once. One is that the flag was on public property, and therefore the public symbolism and the public has a say in the matter. It's not a matter of wearing the flag on your T-shirt. It is thus public sponsorship of the flag, and therefore the public has a role in deciding it. Whether a Confederate flag is appropriate and whether people who find it offensive because of its racist associations should have to bear the cost of it and have it representing them, which is one of the major strands of thought. But also it's a cemetery. If not appropriate in a cemetery over the graves of Confederate soldiers, where is it appropriate? It gets to one issue we haven't discussed, which is the fact that the flag can mean several things at once, and does. I mean, the critical part of the controversies over the flag today is understanding that this symbol can and does mean many things to different people at the same time.
My guest is John Koski, author of the new book, The Confederate Battle Flag. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is John Koski, author of the new book, The Confederate Battle Flag, America's Most Embattled Emblem. He's the historian and library director at the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. The House recently approved a constitutional amendment that would read, "The Congress shall have power to prohibit the physical desecration of the flag of the U.S." Now, yes. Your book is about the Confederate flag, not about the American flag. But I wonder why you think this issue of flag desecration has come back again to the extent that Congress is considering a constitutional amendment that would allow Congress to make desecration illegal.
Of course, the reason it's come back now is post 9/11. The patriotism that swept the nation since 9/11 is at least the occasion for it, if not the cause for it, and why people pushing this amendment believe that it might succeed now where it hasn't in the past. It comes in cycles, of course. And apropos of the Confederate flag, many people may not realize that at least on the books in many states of the South today are laws that are very similar that protect the Confederate flag from desecration. Those were passed first in Mississippi in, I think, 1916, and then as the flag, Confederate flag, that is, became more widely used and abused by the Klan, by teenagers, by bikers, by everyone else, by manufacturers of tacky merchandise in the 1950s and 60s, state laws were passed in South Carolina, in Louisiana, in Georgia, several other states, protecting the Confederate flag from misuse and desecration. But needless to say, those laws became a dead letter at the same time that the laws protecting the U.S. flag were invalidated by the court decisions of 1989 and 1990.
In the South, there are a lot of Civil War monuments, memorials in public places and restaurants. Why do you think that those memorials aren't controversial in the way that flying the Confederate flag is? Because they're basically memorializing, you know, the lost cause in a similar way.
Well, in fact, they are becoming increasingly controversial. The defenders of the flag have long been warning that the flag is simply the tip of the iceberg. One reason for the defensiveness about the flag, why so many of the defenders are fighting tooth and nail to prevent its removal, is that they believe that it's just the top of the slippery slope. They say, the NAACP and other critics say, that they don't want to take down all flags, they just want to take those on public property. But then the next shoe to drop will be all flags, and then beyond that, the monuments. That's been the warning for years. And now, in fact, there are controversies surrounding monuments, for instance, in Memphis, that there are three parks named after Confederate generals or Confederates, Davis and Forrest, and the third I cannot remember. But there's a movement afoot to change the names of the parks and some places to remove the monuments. And just the other day in Portsmouth, Virginia, not for the first time, someone spray-painted the face of one of the monuments to the soldiers of the Confederacy in Portsmouth. That happens occasionally. It's been happening occasionally for decades, but it happens often enough to substantiate the warnings of those that it's not just flags. It will be every vestige of the Confederacy on the southern landscape that is going to have to be removed if we give in now.
What's one of the strangest places, one of the most surprising places you've run into a Confederate flag?
Probably the strangest and place that I encountered the flag was in Europe. When I was traveling in Europe in 1992, as we were starting the research for the exhibit on this subject of the battle flag, and I thought I'd go to Europe and get away from it for a while. Little did I know that everywhere I went in Europe, I was seeing battle flags. We were in Würzburg and passed by a BMW, and the guy had a little battle flag hanging from the rearview mirror. I went into a restaurant in Vienna, and a kid in a leather jacket with a battle flag on the sleeve, on the shoulder rather, with Elvis superimposed over it. In the markets in Florence, with these god-awful T-shirts with battle flags and motorcycle rider death heads and things like that. It's just a real grabber of a symbol. And it has an international shorthand meaning now for not only the South, when used in conjunction with, like, why you see it on so many dust jackets of books when to communicate the South, but it also means in shorthand rebel. and an independent mindset. This flag has become an international symbol of what it is to be a rebel, that is, an individual who puts his middle finger out to the rest of the world.
Well, John Kosky, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
John Kosky is the author of The Confederate Battle Flag. He's the historian and library director at the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Skoll Foundation, proud to sponsor The New Heroes tonight at 8 on PBS, hosted by Robert Redford, stories of social entrepreneurs who are changing the world. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John Danforth, the retired three-term senator from Missouri and Episcopal priest, explains why he's criticizing his fellow Republicans for transforming the party into the political arm of Christian conservatives. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.